They were telling everyone, this guy is a killer sent in by the Kinahan cartel to sort out the Hutches. He was just a lost soul floating around Ireland's underworld. It got him killed. He was quite competent. He knew how to use the weapon. Some of these guys, like, they don't cope with the consequences of what they've done at, you know, at points in their criminal career.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. In the movies, they are portrayed as cool and calculated killers who strike with military precision and disappear into the shadows. But real-life assassins are often the lowly street soldiers of mafia bosses, shackled by drug debts and slaves to their past. Like Caelan Smith, recently jailed for 20 years for a failed Kinahan mafia hit. This week, I'm talking to journalist Eamon Dillon about the army of killers behind bars for their roles in the brutal Hutch and Kinahan feud. He tells me about the drug addicts, the dropouts, and the opportunists who make up the mob's murder cells. And he recalls his own strange encounter with the self-professed killer who talked his way to the grave. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. That was a pretty hefty sentence that Caelan Smith got. I'd say it's probably one of the longest I've seen any of those get, in actual fact, 20 years, staring down quite a long sentence, even though he obviously won't serve the whole lot. He's, we'll come back to him maybe, Eamon. He's somebody that is part of a growing number of prisoners who are in jail because they have taken some money or they've been lured into doing a job for a large criminal organisation, in this case being the Kinahans. You were writing there the other week about an interesting character, Valerius Vins.
Yeah, he was actually lucky in a sense that he didn't get jailed, but it was a real insight into how all this works. This guy, you know, he came over, he was just a kid who arrived in from Latvia 5 years ago. He was like, well, sorry, 5 years before all this happened. He was 18. He was working in the farms. His father died when he was 12. He was one of six kids. The only family he had living in Ireland was another brother. By 2016, early 2016, he owed 20 grand in debt. He developed a drug problem and he was a perfect kind of sucker for more serious criminals to use. What happened was then, he was basically told, you need to meet someone, himself and another 16-year-old now who can't be named, he's too young at the time. The two of them were told, you have to go and collect a parcel and we'll wipe half your debt. So he was told that basically, you're going to go somewhere, you're going to pick up something and you'll only owe us 10 grand instead of 20. So he had no idea what he was going to do or what it was going to be used for or even who he was meeting.
And when was this, Eamon? When are you talking that this happened?
This would have been at the height of the Kinahan-Hutch feud in February 2016. So, I mean, you know, you can imagine, you know, a 25-year-old Latvian and a 16-year-old, you know, Eastern European aren't necessarily going to be reading the newspapers and really have any idea what might be going on above their heads. So the guys set off anyway, leaving the Dublin area. They were getting all their instructions from a burner phone. They would travel along then the M7. They would stop at certain filling stations, presumably getting more instructions. And they ended up, at the railway station in Limerick, and then said at a nearby housing estate. So that's Ballinacurra Western, more than likely, that we'd have known about in the Sunday World over the years as a kind of a heartland of the McCarthy Dundons would have been involved in an awful lot of criminality in that particular area. So all he could say was that a big man in a big coat, middle-aged, dropped something into the boot and off they took again. And they had no, you know, again, they didn't know what was in the boot of the car. And when they got back as far as the toll near Mount Rath in Leash, the Gardaí had them under surveillance all along, it turns out. And when they looked in the car, in the boot, they found a 9mm Glock handgun, fully automatic with 18 rounds. So they were there to do, you know, they were there to do some serious damage. Like, this isn't a collector's item. This is, you know, one of the, you know, sought after sort of weapons used by not just gangland, but also by police forces around the world. It's a very reliable, easy to use handgun. So, I mean, he more or less said what he knew. He couldn't really deny anything. Turns out the guards were able to actually kind of shed light on who it was. When they tracked down his movements in the days beforehand, they found him meeting with a third party at various filling stations. Now, this guy, as we would later find out, turned out to be Jonathan Keogh. So like, this is how Vins had a lucky escape, because that was in February 2016, and Keogh was trying to get a handgun. And in May 2016, Keogh was involved in the shooting dead of Gareth Hutch. In that case, they used a Makarov pistol. So while this plot involving the two young Latvians, like, to get a gun, obviously bought from a gang in Limerick, had failed, they actually did manage then to get their hands on a weapon that they used. And I mean, that particular murder was caught on, as you remember, it was caught on CCTV. Two men rushed out of a flat. They caught their target as he was getting into the car and shot him dead. So it was a pretty kind of no holds barred killing in that sense. Gareth Hutch wasn't even a particularly, you know, high level criminal. It was just simply he was a Hutch, and that was the reason he was killed.
They were wiping them out at that stage. I mean, I think Johnny Keogh himself, as a hitman, was a neighbour of Gareth Hutch, and that is another thing that was used within the community. There was money being offered to people, to spotters, to anybody who was willing to identify a target and take an opportunity to take them out. I mean, that was very much the height of the feud. Your guy, Valerijus Vins, his liaison with all this ended in court the other day. I think you were there to see what happened. Tell us what the conclusion of it was.
Now, this is in Tullamore Circuit Court, and there was Keenan Johnson was the judge in that case. Now, it's a mandatory sentence. It's a 5-year mandatory sentence for carrying a firearm or for being in possession of one. But mandatory sentences Ireland also allow judges, believe it or not, the rigor room, I guess, to take into account the various mitigation. A bit like journalists, I think judges don't like being told what to do. So in this case, he decided that there was no great point in sending this young man to jail. There was evidence given that, you know, in the time, like, since his arrest, it actually dragged on quite a while, partly because Keogh had taken off to the UK and was avoiding arrest at that stage. So he'd relearned a trade. He was now working as a panel beater. His employer thought a lot of him. There was 5,000 bail money that had been put up for him, and it was agreed then that this would be paid over by way of a donation to charity. And so he was given a 3-year sentence and was suspended for 10 years, which I guess he was lucky. I mean, he did have some previous, but they were all road traffic, and I think that's really what saved him. And the fact that he did come from a particularly tough background, and Judge Johnson was happy to accept that. And certainly there was a detective Garda who gave evidence that said that they genuinely, like, that the threats were genuine and that he genuinely believed them. Because Vans had talked about, he had a girlfriend, a young boy at that time, and he was basically in fear of not only his life, but that they would be harmed as well, which was, it wasn't just the €10,000. That was the secondary motivation.
And it was very interesting that you found this case and that you were able to attend it, because this was one that wasn't one of the more high profile cases that we talk about, like Caelan Smith this week and others. I mean, this is one of the ones that would have slipped under the radar had you not followed up and attended that. And it's interesting that here was a guy that, you know, owed 20,000. He had obviously built that up over a short space of time. But for some people, 20,000 is just an enormous amount of money. There is no way of paying it back. And they are. That fear is so real that something's going to happen to them or their families, that they will take on these jobs. Very high risk transporting a gun that could have been used in a murder. I suppose, you know, his story is a classic one. There's a number of different motivations that bring people to a murder cell or to, you know, to be taking up a freelance role as an assassin. All of them go back to money, either the desire to earn that money or that somebody owes money and are frightened. I don't think very many kill by choice. And in the drug world, there is this sort of sense of shared guilt when it comes to drug dealing, because somebody is willingly buying the product off you. So you may feel bad about it, but ultimately they're making the choice as well. But when it comes to murder, it's completely and utterly different. And morally, like a lot of people, will find themselves involved in it. And in later life, they have serious regrets. And sometimes it can eat away at them themselves. But there's at the moment more than 30 people in jail in this country, just in relation to murder attempts and murders that have been carried out in relation to the feud, the Kinahan-Hutch feud. These people are, lots of them anyway, have educational problems, they've money problems, they've had family and personal problems. Some of them have a low IQ. You know, it's not the big role in a drug gang to be a killer or to be helping out in a attempted murder. You know, what sort of people are they? How are they being plucked, these soldiers? Where are they being found in on the streets? And where are the likes of the gang leaders finding people?
I think an instructive case in that regard to answer some of those questions would be the cells that were set up by the Kinahan cartel to try and kill Patsy Hutch, a brother of the Monk. He lives in Champions Avenue in the city centre of Dublin, just off O'Connell Street. And that was, those arrests came in March 2018. It was a serious win for the guards in this case. I mean, they had these guys under surveillance all along, which is where we get this fascinating insight from. And some of the actual comments were played in court. They were like, it's incredible. Like when you ask who these guys were, I mean, you have like the way they set it up is that you had your cell leader, which in this case was Patrick Curtis, and he was the only person with the encrypted phone that was talking to somebody, presumably talking to the higher echelons. And they gave that mystery person in the higher echelons, they gave him the nickname Lord Knows. So Lord Knows was sending these encrypted messages to Patrick Curtis. He was a guy from Dublin's north inner city who unfortunately suffers serious claustrophobia, which is unfortunate for the guy who's now doing a 12-year stretch. Now, he wasn't probably the best guy for the job. I think his own brother, Stephen, who's on the next level, said as much to some of the other co-conspirators. Like, he had the encrypted phone, but unfortunately, he couldn't remember the messages because they were self-deleting too quickly. So he had to photograph them with his own phone, which then, in turn, left a trail of evidence for the guards to figure out who was who when they did pound. So it didn't work quite well in that sense. So you had Patrick Curtis at the top. He was the director of the operation in Ireland, and he was the only one in direct contact with the higher echelons. Now, the next guys down, you had Michael Burns on one side, and then you had his brother Stephen Curtis on the other side. Now, actually, it was interesting. Like, Patrick was actually saying to Burns at one stage, this is him on tape, he's saying he gets it wrong all the time. He always gets it wrong. He's wrong bringing people into that coffee shop. And he was referring to this, there's a coffee shop on the north side of the city where he was regularly meeting up with the other kind of eight members of the cell that were going to, you know, carry out the hit. And he complained that he's used by guards all the time. And so he was talking about his own brother. So as well as them, like in the first attempt, the two hitmen then were going to be these two other chaps, Mohammed Smew and Mark Capper. Now, Mark Capper...
These guys were going to be the trigger men, is that the case?
Yeah. And now
they were holding the firearms, yeah.
Yeah, now he's been... Now, it's interesting, Mark Capper, he's described as having, you know, a very low IQ. It was mentioned in court, he had an IQ of 63. He suffered from ADHD. He had a very low standard of education. And was in special school. But when you actually listen back or look at some of the statements they made, he was actually one of the smarter guys in terms of, he was pointing out where all the errors were in this plot. What they wanted to do was to cause some kind of commotion at Patsy Hutch's daughter's house, and then that he'd come running or he'd come to the rescue, and then the hitmen would be waiting for him and they'd shoot him. And then they had their plan to get away using another van. So there was quite a few flaws, really, when you consider how many guards were in that area. Plus, there was a wheel hanging off the van at the time. The motorbike that was going to be used as well, when it went at a certain speed, you know, there was a problem with it. So you had Mohammed Smew then as well. Now, the thing is, both of these, they were both absolutely broke. I mean, they were heard on tape kind of asking the other for a loan, 50 quid, and says, sorry, mate, I don't have it. I mean, the two of them were absolutely bust broke. Now, Smew, on the other hand, he actually came from a good background. His parents were doctors, but he suffered an accident, and I think he got into drug addiction as a result of that, ended up homeless. So you have a homeless guy, you have a guy like who was in special school, and these are the two guys who are going to carry out the hit. And then the third man on that particular cell was this guy, Kieran O'Driscoll, who was basically a neighbour of Patsy Hutch's. And he was a drug addict with, I think, something like 90 previous convictions. So again, he was doing it for the money. Now, earlier at this stage, I think Curtis had been given €7,000, like for expenses. Obviously, €40 went on repairing the tire on the van that was going to be used as the getaway. So, Storm Emma then, actually, if you remember, in 2018 was the heavy snow, and that's when you remember then Smew was one of the guys then that was arrested for breaking into the little store in Tala. So like that's the level of you know, high level gangster that you're talking about. So in the end, like, Capper's objections were seen as that he wasn't really up to the job, and the two of them were discarded. They were no longer going to be used in the murder plot, and instead then you had Glenn and Gary Thompson from Finglas were brought in. Now, they were like, Glenn was a small time criminal, drug habit, minor criminal convictions, and at the time it was said, you know, it was that time he was suffering emotional turmoil as a result of a death in the family. And his brother, who was much older than him, actually was recruited in as well. And as well as that, they had a former British Army soldier who had served in Hemland province, and he was going to be the trigger man, this guy called Robert Brown. So they were all set to go. Again, they were talking about the cash. Brown has heard, you know, he's heard again, like the guard of Bugs talking about, he's telling one of the Thompsons as they drove around, he says, oh, I'm going to get you 15 grand out of this. So this is a guy who was, as far as he was concerned, he was a mercenary doing a job. And it was, you know, it wasn't for revenge. It wasn't personal. It was for cash, cold hard cash. And that was the only reason he was getting into it. Unfortunately for him, the entire operation from the very beginning was under, you know, really tight surveillance. So they were all picked up, and all of this eventually came out in the Special Criminal Court. In fact, the evidence was lined up and stacked up against them so much, all nine members just pleaded guilty. There was no point in even trying to contest the charges.
You know, when you think that, and Patsy Hutch was somebody that the Kinahan organisation really, really want dead. I mean, he's still a top target there, and both himself and James Mago Gately have survived a number of attempts that were being plotted. But 100 grand would have been in and around, they say, they talk about between 100 and 200 grand would have been what it would have earned them to kill him that day. I remember that day, I think it was a Saturday. And I think they were the good old days, Eamon, when we were in the office. Despite the fact we would have complained back then, it seems like a dream now to be, back in our office with all our colleagues around us. But yeah, it was about 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the afternoon when they busted that gang, and they were hoping that he was going to walk up the street. They were going to shoot him in broad daylight on the streets of the city centre. For anyone who doesn't know, Champions Avenue is literally just off O'Connell Street. So it's very city centre. And since the Regency Hotel attack, there has been guard presence on that street because of such as the critical threat to the life of Patsy Hutch, the monk's brother. But they were still going to try and do that. But when you think, if you divided that money up nine times, there's not very much actual earnings out of that. And then they had to pay their expenses on top of it. You know, it's not really that somebody's going to get rich by doing the worst job in gangland. And as I said, so high risk. You were talking there about the bugs and the cars. And in the last year or so, I was in and out of the courts, dipping in and out of these cases that are ongoing largely in the Special Criminal Court. And there was another murder cell actually that was busted as well by the guards. And this was a plot to murder a guy called Gary Hanley, who's an associate also of the Hutch side. And five guys, Liam Branigan and Dean Howe, who would be veteran Kinahan associates, and Joseph Kelly, Luke and Alan Wilson, all pleaded guilty in relation to that conspiracy to murder. They too were all under surveillance and being bugged when they were plotting to kill Gary Hanley. And for 2 days in court, they played those recordings, and they were just quite fascinating to listen to them. I sat through them. You know, they reminded me of the way we'd be on a surveillance operation. If we were out in the car or in the jeeps with one of the photographers and you were sitting waiting for somebody and you get bored. And like, it is probably the most boring job in the world doing that sort of surveillance stuff. So here they were sitting outside a house, waiting for an opportunity to kill Gary Hanley. Totally, he's inside, totally unaware, carrying on with life. He's a small baby. They talk about in the car, firstly, they bring tea and biscuits with them to keep them going while they're sitting watching this house. They talk about him. They talk about, you know, how they're going to go about killing him. What are they going to do if he has the baby in his arms? Well, look, you know, we don't want to necessarily purposely hurt the baby, but if the baby gets hit by a ricochet bullet, then that's fair game. And this is the kind of conversations these guys are having. They talk about their girlfriends. They talk about their children. There's a birthday coming up and two of them are discussing the price of the mobile phones the kids want and where they're going to get it and how cheap they can get it. They were arrested, by the way, that time in November of 2017. So it was coming up to Christmas and you can hear them discussing how they need to get this hit done because they need to get paid for the Christmas. They want the money for Christmas. And, you know, at one point, actually, I was in court and a group of transition year students came in to the courtroom. And sometimes some of the evidence can be a little bit inappropriate, you know, but they just happened to come in and sit down at this particular moment when Joseph Kelly, who again is a drug addict, you know, somebody disadvantaged and with a large record. And he's explaining to Alan Wilson, who's a more maybe notorious criminal. They're sitting there watching Hanley and he says to him, do you know, I can't drink whiskey. I just can't get it into me. But if you take Captain Morgan's and you mix it with Club Orange, it just tastes like a Solero ice pop. And I was actually sitting there going, oh God, we better get the transition year pupils out here. That'll be totally inappropriate for them to hear. But in the meantime, you sort of nearly yourself kind of forget what's going on because you're listening to this very normal conversation, inappropriate, albeit for fourth years. But they are actually waiting to take a man's life. And they're going to take his life for the payment that'll, you know, cover Christmas. And that's the reality of this situation. That's how little life means for these guys and how much they just see it as a job. But Eamon, you were writing recently about how much they get paid or how much, you know, what is it worth? What is a life worth nowadays?
Yeah, this is something that Europol put together, obviously from different reports from different, you know, member police agencies around Europe. And they came up with the idea that it was somewhere between 10,000 and 100,000 is basically the cost of a contract killing, which from what we've just been discussing would sound a little at the high end. You know, I mean, like at the height of the kind of the feuding in Limerick, I mean, the figure that somebody, you know, that was touted, what a so-called professional hitman in the city would get, tended to be around 5,000, you know, which it just shows you how incredibly, you know, cheap life is. But even to go back to when you're discussing, like, you know, that the guys in the Hanley trial, like in the very, very mundane kind of ordinary boringness of the people involved, and then they carry out something so horrible and heinous or are prepared to do it. And it's just, like, you see that so often. I mean, even just recently, there was a court case. Unfortunately, it's two people are before the courts. It's a major drugs haul. And one of them had said to the guards at the time, I did what I had to do to keep everyone safe. But just looking at them, they're like two fellas you'd see out, you know, driving a van, doing a bit of fishing, going for a few beers in the pub. Like, there was nothing extraordinary about them. You know, and these are the people who tend to get sucked in. So, I mean, I think that was kind of reflected in what the Europol kind of report was talking about, that a lot of it's a mix. I mean, obviously, you know, you'd have certain criminal organizations like some of the Italian mafias where, you know, they might have particular people that'll carry out certain types of hits that have to be done very carefully because they don't want to, they're probably not worried about the police. They're probably worried about upsetting other people in the criminal underworld. And they have to be carried out far more carefully, where somebody completely disappears, but there has to be a reason why they might have disappeared, as opposed to being deliberately murdered. But in terms of, like, if you just want somebody to have a go at, you know, another street level dealer, like, it's pretty cheap. So, like, obviously this is where, you know, other agencies have picked up, you know, similar kind of surveillance audio the way they have done with the Patsy Hutch, you know, the attempt to kill Patsy Hutch and Gary Hanley. Like, one of the things they talk about in it as well is that one of the mistakes that police in Europe have been doing is seeing it as a single jurisdictional event, and that it's usually, you know, again, it's more than that. I mean, we saw it with the likes of David Hunter, who was, you know, came from Liverpool for his role in the Michael Barr killing. I mean,
just explain that to me a little bit, David Hunter. Why was he coming from Liverpool to be involved in a murder here? Surely the idea of flying in, and was he flying back out, or what was his deal with that?
Yeah, well, he was one of these guys. Presumably, you have to imagine that the contact is coming from the Kinahan cartel people that were operating in the north of England. We know that Thomas Bomber Kavanagh was for years there in Birmingham. He's facing a long sentence now for a huge drugs conspiracy charge. So the likes of Hunter would have been within the orbit of, you know, Kinahan cartel people. So they're looking for clean skin, somebody that can come over that, you know, won't be known to the guards, so they can have a quick surveillance of the area. He came over with his girlfriend. They were getting basically off their heads on drinking drugs in a hotel or in Swords at the time. And then there was a fairly volatile relationship, so she encouraged one of her girlfriends to come over and keep her company. And the two women went off shopping together while Hunter was the guy, one of the two that went out then and shot Michael Barr dead. And the next day, you know, or sorry, he went back then and went drinking with the two women in Temple Bar, you know, in some kind of, you know, half-hearted attempt at covering his tracks.
And Eamon, just to stop you there in case people don't remember, but there was something particularly horrifying about that Michael Barr killing. Barr was accused by the Kinahan cartel mafia of being involved in the Regency Hotel attack. He was somebody with links to dissident Republicans from the north, and he was suspected of being involved in various things himself. But he was working in the Sunset House bar in the city centre as a barman. And the night he was killed, he was serving behind the bar. And there were local people in there having a drink when in came two gunmen dressed in Freddy Krueger masks and shot him dead in front of their eyes. Including in the pub that night was a young man with special needs who was in the area, and he used to go up every night for a couple of ale pints and somebody would drop him home. And those people can never be the same again.
But it's something that I think you wrote about, Nicola, was that the standard of proof in, you know, the criminal circles, you know, that condemned Michael Barr to death was so low. He was shot because he was thought to be a dissident Republican from Strabane, the same place as the man in the flat cap, Murray, who was seen running from the Regency Hotel. So he was known to have known him. So that was enough for him to suggest, for the Kinahan suggest, that he must have had something to do with the supply of the AK-47s that were used by the Hutch gang members who went into the Regency Hotel dressed as guards. And that was the reason he was shot. So, you know, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, like, you know, it's just in front of all those people, that was it's a community pub right in the corner there, you know, up near Summerhill. And I think someone else tried to run the pub again afterwards, but it's since shut down. So, I mean, it took away an amenity, I guess, from the local community.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a long-lasting effect on, apart from the people that, you know, the totally innocent people that had to witness it, but, you know, on the,
did,
on the family as well.
Did Hunter fly home after it, or what happened with him?
He was supposed to go to Thailand with the driver of the getaway car, but it turned out then his passport was out of date. So he spent 900 quid on getting a second ticket after getting an emergency passport from Store Street Garda Station, where he went in to get his, all his papers stamped, and flew off then. And he ended up in Spain, and his girlfriend flew out to meet him, the long-suffering girlfriend. And when he hadn't turned up at the airport to meet her, she turned tail and went straight back home. So, you know, it's just, it's, in one sense, it's laughable. I mean, it's tragic, but it's just laughable that these, I mean, he was a Liverpudlian car thief. His excuse for having one of his trips to Dublin beforehand when he was meeting with the Kinnan cartel was that he was coming over to Dublin to steal cars to order. That was excuse to the guards, and there was no evidence that he stole anything, and he flew back the next day. So, you're talking about, you know, real low-level criminals that are just, you know, they're just fodder. I mean, as far as the higher, you know, the top brass and the Kinnan cartel are concerned, like, they're headed for an early grave or a jail cell. They don't really care.
They just completely used them. What conviction did Hunter get?
He was jailed for life.
Oh, he was charged and convicted of murder.
Yeah, he managed to leave his burner phone at the scene and they also didn't set fire to the car properly. So they're basically able to track him down as a result of that.
So, and the other person in jail for life for that is Eamon Cumberton, again, a North Inner City local who had links to the INLA and who wanted to make money. And from the beginning, he was the guy. I mean, I think he is suspected of having travelled to perhaps have a look at some other hits before the Regency happened, and which are all part of the fabric of the feud. You know, the likes of Hunter and, as you say, the other guys that just look so normal and so ordinary, you would imagine that ordinariness is something that would be required as a hitman. But another one I sat in awe at in our courts, in the special criminal courts, was Imre Arrakis, the Estonian, known in his homeland as the Butcher, sent over to Ireland in 2017 to murder James Mago Gately and to have a look at other sort of members of the Hutch faction that the Kinahans were trying to take out at the time. So he is really different. I mean, he's not your kind of street level thug. This guy, there cannot possibly be too many of these, because Imre Arrakis is not only a hitman, but he is a celebrity in his home country. He, as I said to you, he started out with the nickname The Butcher. He was an Estonian who spent 15 years in a Russian jail. When he got out, he got involved in some gang wars between Estonians and Russians, which must have been really pretty nasty. He survived it himself, but I think 100 people died in that feud, which is five times really the amount from the Kinahan Hutch feud, if you think about it that way. He fled to the south coast of Spain, along with many of our well-known criminals from all over Europe and beyond. And there he also survived an assassination, but he was there from about the late 90s and into the early 2000s, really when that Kinahan organization was beginning to blossom. And he became a freelance assassin. So he hired out his services to whoever wanted him. And he is suspected of a lot of killings, including one in Lithuania, where a man who had an affair with a pop princess was shot dead. But as a killer for hire, he was sent to Ireland in this effort to kill both Mago Gately and possibly Patsy Hutch. He flew in posing as a fisherman with a tent on his back and took the bus from Dublin Airport into the city centre. He went into a couple of shops in O'Connell Street and bought a few bits that would do him as a disguise. And he walked up along Champions Avenue and had a look at Patsy Hutch's house. He had a look at the spot where Gareth Hutch was murdered. And then he made his way out to a house where he had spent the night before the cops burst in. The guards from the Drugs and Organised Crime Bureau had been watching him all along, and he was lifted. So when he appeared in court, like, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like him. He's absolutely enormous. He is absolutely huge. He's like a big Neanderthal man, right? With this long, flowing, whitey, blondy hair and these piercing blue eyes. Like, I think he was kind of seen as a bit of a James Bond type character. Quite a good-looking man, very distinctive anyway. And, like, it just, you're looking at him going, how did he ever think he was going to blend in anywhere? In particular here in Ireland. I mean, he really stood out. For me, I was quite speechless when I saw him in the flesh. He subsequently was found guilty of conspiracy to murder Mag O'Gately. He has a sentence here in Ireland, which he's serving, and then he's going to be extradited directly to Lithuania, where he will face those murder charges in relation to the chap who was killed because of his links to the pop star. So the end of the road for him. But certainly he stood out for me. And I think you had a little interaction with somebody who was probably the only other one I can think of that looked so different and strange and was all that. Tell me about Hamid Sanambar.
I think he's kind of the polar opposite to the Estonian super criminal, celebrity super criminal. I mean, Hamid Sanambar, as far as the Gucci gang, which I suppose will bring us on to Caelan Smith, as far as the Gucci gang were concerned, they were telling everyone, this guy is a killer from Syria, sent in by the Kinahan cartel to sort out the Hutches. And he was regularly seen with them. He looked the part in his leather jacket, his two teardrops tattooed in his face, supposedly signifying, you know, having taken a life or seeking revenge for two murders. And when I saw his pictures, his picture turned up when I think it was Sean Little was killed and the car was burning outside North County Dublin, and a group of the...
This was the summer of 2019 when there was an explosion of violence in that sort of Coolock area and within those gangs. There had been a taming of the violence within the Kinahan Hutch feud and a sort of a, not a relaxation, but maybe a belief that this had calmed down a bit and the guards had got a handle out of it. All of a sudden, Sean Little was murdered, and months after his pal Zach Parker, two young drug dealers.
And in the middle of this is Hamid Sanambar. And it took a little while for the penny to drop. And then I remembered, I'd seen him before, and it was 4 years before. He had actually phoned up the Sunday World and he said, look, I have a good story to tell you. And needless to say, you know, you talk to someone over the phone, you kind of assess it. So I went down and I met him. He was living in a flat in Longford. And my first impression was, again, this guy was absolutely flat broke. I mean, he had nothing, he didn't have two pennies to rub together. He was living in this, like, a flat in the middle of the town. Like, it was sparse, it was barely, furnished. And he did a good kind of impression of looking over his shoulder, checking the blinds, you know, opening doors slightly, looking around corners as if he was under surveillance. So, you know, he was one of these, you know, kind of hyper-vigilant sort of, intelligence operatives. Anyway, he just talked and talked and talked for about 90 minutes and it was nonstop. And he seemed to know everything about crime in Ireland. Now, he either was what he said he was, like plugged into all of this stuff, or else he had done a forensic read of everything the Sunday World, you know, had published in the previous 10 years. But he really did, you know, he certainly gave the impression he knew a lot about it. But when he veered off the stuff that wasn't public knowledge, nothing could be verified. Now, I'd no doubt that he was involved, or he was some kind of, you know, a hanger-on some of the crime gangs that, you know, we subsequently know a bit more about in Longford. They've been involved in drugs, prostitution, protection rackets, stolen machinery. So he was onto something. But anyway, he turned up like as the driver for one of the Gucci gang. And my information from some people who remembered him from his Longford days was said that he's basically working for pizza slices. And that's, you know, so this image of this, you know, hardened Syrian killer.
Now, had he got those teardrop tattoos when you met him in Longford?
No, he didn't. And he didn't have the scorpion tattoo on his ear either. So, I mean, he'd obviously picked those up along the way and it improved his image. But when I met him, he told me he was an Iranian, which it turns out was true. He was an Iranian. and that he fled the country, that he was part of he was you know, part of kind of a political resistance. He more or less admitted, he said he just fought the police because he liked fighting. And he showed me that he had really deep cuts on his wrist, where obviously he had been hung by his wrist. So there was some element of truth to it. Like, there was no doubt he was a damaged young man. Like, one of the things that you could find out about him at the time was that he had taken part in the robbery of a brothel. And there was $5,000 taken. A woman had a jaw broken and a laptop taken, that sort of thing. But he says that he had only went along to make sure that the other two people were caught. And he claimed to have told the guards in advance that this was going to happen. And so he really wanted to become an undercover informant for the guards, and that obviously failed. So his next step then was to ring the Sunday World and become an undercover informant. I shouldn't laugh. It was to become an undercover informant for us. I mean, God love him. I mean, it got him killed, because, I mean, he talked his way into a serious crime gang.
He did, and he was actually, after the murder of Sean Little, Little was a young 23-year-old, maybe 22-year-old, and he was found dead beside a car out in the Balbriggan area. But days later, at his wake, Hamid Sanambar was shot dead in the front garden of Sean Little's house. Now, nobody has been identified as the killer, but it is largely understood that he was kind of blamed on something to do, and possibly wrongly blamed on something to do with Sean Little's murder, and may have been a token retaliation very early during those sort of heady few days after that killing. He talked himself into the gang, as you say, and talked himself up, and we don't know really much about his background, do we, whether it was true or not. But the rumours when he was hanging around with those Gucci gang were that he was a torture expert. He had, you know, he was being sent over directly, supposedly at one point it was saying he was sent over directly by Daniel Kinahan, and that he was his personal killer and he was here in Ireland to finish off the Hutch gang. He certainly looked different. I'm not sure in this country about wearing tattoos on your face if you're trying to blend in the crowd. What was your feeling on him having met him? Was he a fantasist that got in too deep, or?
I walked away from that meeting thinking, you know, I'll see what the guy has to say in the future and take it from there. But my impression was that he was a clever spoofer. Like, he was a clever guy who was well able to use facts up to a point. But then when it came to the crunch, you kind of knew he wasn't going to deliver. But he was good at what he did, you know. There was like he sounded the part, and it just when you went to verify anything he had said, it was always impossible to actually verify it. So that was why he was gifted, and there was no doubt that he kind of was given the impression he was further up the criminal chain than he was. And probably one of the reasons he was killed was that he had said so many different things, he couldn't remember what he had said. But also the fact that if he was killed, there was nobody going to take any revenge from, because he didn't really belong to anyone in Ireland. He was just to some extent, a lost soul floating around Ireland's underworld, and it got him killed.
And the other thing, I suppose, that separated him from the others in the Gucci gang was that he was in his 40s and the rest of them were all in their 20s. Now, Caelan Smith, who this week was jailed for 20 years and where we started, he was one of them. He was knocking around in that Gucci gang, and he was a guy who, when Imre Arrakis was stopped in his tracks on his way to kill Mago Gately, he took up the bounty and he decided that he would wipe out what we suspect may have been a debt to the Kinahans, a pretty hefty one. 200,000 is what he was suspected to have owed them. What happened the day that he decided to see if he could finish off Gately?
Again, like, they obviously had their information on Gately, and they were basically followed him or were waiting for him when he arrived at a Topaz garage, and just opened fire. And again, it was one of these reckless attacks. There was there was unrelated vehicles that weren't belonging to any, you know, there were members of the public which were hit. I mean, the only thing that saved Gately was the fact that he was wearing a bulletproof vest. He was hit five times, and the fifth one actually went through his jaw. And it was only, basically, it was the paramedics who arrived on the scene and the people who were there initially that saved his life and stopped him bleeding to death or smothering. So, I mean, Smith, like, he was quite competent in a sense that, you know, he knew how to use the weapon. He'd obviously had practiced, or, you know, had basic competency in that regard. Like, and again, he wasn't a low member of a criminal organization. Like, to build up a 200,000 euro debt, you know, it wasn't from using the product yourself. So, like, in that regard, he was at the opposite end of, you know, of Vins that we spoke about at the start, the young Latvian farmhand. Whereas, you know, Smith was at the other end of the criminal ladder. But at the same time, he was pretty much manipulated into doing what he had to do. I mean, like, it's a real internecine feud what's going on in Coolock. I mean, and again, Smith, you know, had spent time growing up in Drogheda. Like, to some extent, he didn't know who was after him, but there was a number of people after him. And a 200,000 euro debt was his. And this is one way of, possibly it was a ticket out of town, possibly it was a way of getting the money back or more. And that's why he did it. But, you know, no more than Vince, you know, the youngster working in the fields, he was manipulated into it. I mean, you can have less sympathy for him. And certainly the judge did in this case, who gave him 20 years, which you were saying is, like, you know, it's a steep sentence by Irish standards. I mean, 20 years is sometimes longer than what, you know, somebody who gets life, you know, will actually serve. I noticed this morning when he was after sentencing, he shouted to, or he mentioned it to family members, 5 World Cups and I'll be out. But that's actually, I was working it out, it'll probably be 3 World Cups when he gets out, you know, with standard remission, and depending when it's on. So he'll be out sooner than he thinks.
Caelan Smith had a start to life. Look, they all put up a defence, you know, when they're, and in sentencing, all these guys will lean on the disadvantages of their youth in order to sort of get a lesser sentence, or for it to be certainly considered by the judge. We know that. But at the same time, there is stories in all of their pasts. And Caelan Smith was somebody who was a champion boxer, who seemed to be going on the right way in life until his parents split up. And he just seems to have become very chaotic. Certainly when I was looking at him before, there seemed to have been an older individual who was circling him in his teenage years and who steered him maybe into crime. And that's unfortunately for him where he ended up with his 20 years. This, you know, that's the culmination of it. Mago, the attempt on Mago Gately was in May 2017. By 2019, Caelan Smith was still in trouble. He was smack bang in the middle of the Sean Little Hamid Sanambar situation. And he actually went to the UK and did a polygraph test and sent it back and put it up on WhatsApp. It went around all these WhatsApp groups saying he had nothing to do with Sean Little's murder, that there was no way he had double-crossed him. I think that certainly associates of Little would disagree. It's a chaotic world, and it seems that the rewards are very small given the risk, and I suppose the risk from a point of view of criminal justice, but also morally, because the likes of Smith have a long time in prison, don't they, to think about what they've done or what they could have done and what's the meaning of life and death.
Well, very much. I mean, you're in a, 4x6 meters cell or less than that. It's a long time to think about it. I remember one time years ago, I was asking some contact about a particular person who had contacted me. This is a guy with no record, but had obviously been involved in criminality in the past. But he was quite religious and was very much at the forefront of a lot of born again Christian meetings. And I kind of said, like, you know, is this, what's the story with this guy? And he says, well, he's like a lot of these guys, you know, he's killed a few people and he's feeling guilty about it now. And he's looking for God. So, I mean, some of these guys, like, they don't really cope with what they end up, you know, they don't cope with the consequences of what they've done at, you know, at points in their criminal career.
Absolutely. Eamon Dillon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nicola.
From SundayWorld.com, this is Crime World, produced by Ian Mullaney. Available online and on all podcast platforms. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. And if you want to get in touch, check out our Facebook page, Crime World with Nicola Tallant.